When something happens to your kitchen, you might say,
"This is ludicrous."
But that won't fix your home. That will only get you the rapper, Ludacris.
Having trouble? Don't panic. Don't be alarmed. You need to file a claim? Holla at State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. You can file a claim on the app or call us.
Thanks, Mr. Chris.
No matter how ludicrous the situation, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Welcome to another episode of Pop Law Podcast. I'm your host, Desiree, and I'm still not your attorney. We are switching things up on the third episode of the interview series. Today, we will not be having an attorney, but an amazing businesswoman to join us. Our brand partnerships episode was so successful and got a lot of great feedback that I thought it was a great idea to expand our brand partnerships talk and to also focus a little bit more on events since the world is opening back up and we are all ready to get outside. So without further ado, I would like to introduce you all to Sunny Day. Sunny Day is an event producer and creative strategist whose love for process and planning, hashtag Virgo, combined with her creativity and commitment to making things beautiful, has led her to the biggest metropolitan cities across the U.S. and Europe. Sunny has worked on teams supporting some of the most influential brands and names in consumer goods, music, and entertainment. An L.A. native and Brooklyn resident, Sunny's aesthetic is reflective of her dynamic personality, various interests, and experiences living on two vastly different coasts. Sunny builds immersive experiences for brands committed to telling culturally relevant, authentic, and inclusive stories across art, fashion, media, and tech industries. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sunny Day.
Hi, Desi. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Sunny. I am so happy to have you on, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation because we are all ready to be outside.
Oh, amen. Amen. I'm very excited to be here.
So tell me a little bit about all the brands you've worked with. I didn't want to read them off. You have done so many great things. So give us a little bit of a snippet of your favorites.
Okay. Well, I'm here for all the gas. I worked across a few different experiential agencies and creative agencies. And I've also worked in-house for brands, which is kind of why the brands that I've worked with and have collaborated with are a bit extensive. I think some of my favorites are definitely, in no particular order, Nike, Google, The Creative Collective, and CultureCon, Live Nation. I actually was both in-house and worked on some of their event and activations. Instagram just did a really fun project highlighting Black creatives with them in collaboration with the Creative Collective, New York City. I guess those are some of just off the top of my head, some quick ones that I've really enjoyed.
Yeah, those are definitely top brands. And I love that, you know, you threw some Black brands in there too. Obviously, Creative Collective. If you are a New York listener, you should know about the Creative Collective and the marquee event CultureCon that we do. So that's how Sunny and I actually met a few years ago. Was it CultureCon number two? Maybe the third year. That's when we start working together. But we met prior to that at other Creative Collective events, not related to CultureCon. But yeah, we start working on CultureCon together. So, I mean, I guess while we're on the topic of CultureCon, and CultureCon is coming up in the next couple of months, you know, we still are in this pandemic, but we're having digital events. Tell me a little bit about your experience going from in-person events to digital.
Yeah, it has been an adjustment for sure. I think one of the biggest, not hurdles, but kind of biggest points and thoughts of like things of interest for me is trying to recreate some of those in-person experiences in a digital destination. I think in particular, when I think about Black events, right? One of the first thing that comes to mind for me is music. There's always, it doesn't matter if it's a baby shower, if it's a 90th birthday party, there's always some kind of music integration. And so it's like, okay, how do we create a live DJ or a playlist or something that still keeps people engaged and still makes it feel like it's fun and kind of eventizes it a bit. So just really trying to figure out, like, what are those moments that people like, whether it's subconscious and they don't really realize it, but if the experience is then missing that, it becomes really noticeable and palpable. Like, how do you recreate those type of things in a digital landscape?
Music drives everything, like Black culture drives everything. So I love that you said that. And that definitely speaks to me and just the lawyer in me, like the music licenses that you have to have now, these digital services. Yeah, it's expensive. A lot of people don't realize, you know, how important music is to us, but you have to pay for that. So I'm just reminded of an agreement that so now I work in the editorial space and we do a lot of digital content also. And you know, our business teams want to use music and video, so we try to steer them away from that. But we're like, hey, you might pay $25,000 to play 30 seconds of a song. So if you have that in your budget, you could do it. But if not, steer away from the music and try to get all the free music that's out there, not popular culture music. Yes.
It's funny you say that, though, because that is something that kind of continues to come up in conversation as we do planning for digital. Because, you know, I think in person, you hire a DJ. That's a flat rate. And they just know to read the vibes and read the rooms. But with this, it's because there is a cost associated with each song. You have to have foresight. And it might not be a top 40 song that you get access to, because that, you know, is going to, the popularity is going to kind of be complementary to whatever it costs. So I think digital requires a lot more like anticipating the needs of your audience and then like planning for that. In a way that you probably don't really have to, like, yeah, in person, if, okay, it looks like the mood is going down, let's turn back that ass up or something where people get excited. Yeah. We do that in digital. It's like, we did it.
Right. And I think one thing that people also forget is like in the event space when it's live, typically the venue has these licenses, these public performance licenses where, you know, if we're throwing an event there, we don't have to worry about, is it okay for us to play this music in the space? Because, you know, we'll make sure that the venue has that covered. And I know that's, you know, going too deep into legal, but that is also something when people try to do events, whether it's in person or digital, there is another component. Make sure that that event space has this public performance license, because you can't hire a DJ, but you know, there has to be that license, or whoever, however the agreement says, somebody go be liable if they find out that you play music and don't have a license.
Wait, but that was a gem. I'm actually gonna have to put that in my back pocket.
We're now on digital events. We have all the, well, the world is opening up. How do you think you can grasp the audience still having these digital and virtual events when, you know, different states are opening up?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think one, it boils down to like being honest with yourself, right? We recognize that people have Zoom fatigue. Like, people are on the computer all day for work. They don't necessarily want to spend their weekends doing that. I mean, it'll be 66 degrees in New York and sunny, and I'm like, okay, like, what meeting can I cut short? Can I take a walk? Because we've been cooped up for so long. So I think knowing that, like, your numbers just might not be what you want them to be, because, you know, there are a lot more distractions in simulation. But then also really trying to capitalize on like really unique and interesting content. And that, I think, and I hope, we'll see if CultureCon will influence people to stay and to be engaged. But that requires a really intimate knowledge of your audience and whoever it is you're marketing to, like knowing what they want to see and being able to rise to the occasion and offer them that.
And how do you get brands involved in this new digital world. I know, you know, CultureCon is very brand heavy when we were in person and everyone loved it. But are brands still excited to do these virtual conferences?
I think the beauty of that, at least for right now, and this might change as the landscape changes and people go outside a bit more, brands are not like humans in that brands are worried about like liability, right? Even though people are ready to be outside, a lot of brands aren't so much ready to touch in-person events yet because there's a lot of liability associated with that. So if you are interested in trying to lock in brand partnerships, I think now is still a really good time to try and capitalize on that. But keeping in mind too, very similar to in-person, brands are thinking about things quarters ahead. So you have to be really quick and have the foresight to know, okay, if I'm trying to have an event in June, I'm not going to start outreach in May. I've probably started having these like warm-up conversations and exploratory conversations as early as February. You know what I mean? And sometimes
when something happens to your kitchen, you might say,
"This is ludicrous."
But that won't fix your home. That will only get you the rapper, Ludacris.
Having trouble? Don't panic. Don't be alarmed. You need to file a claim? Holla at State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. You can file a claim on the app or call us.
Thanks, Mr. Chris.
No matter how ludicrous the situation, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Before that, especially if you don't have any kind of like pre-existing relationship with these people, you can't just spring a deck on them or cold email a couple weeks before your project and expect that they still have budget allocated for whatever it is you're trying to do. So definitely, I think both in person and virtual, the brands are interested. It just takes whoever's seeking those partnerships to have the foresight to know when it is they're planning something, when to realistically start outreach and having those conversations, and to have your offerings really hammered out so that people know what they're buying into.
And what do you mean by offerings?
So I think it's important to detail exactly what it is you're asking people for. So whether it's monetary donations, in-kind donations, if it's products, whatever the case, I think you need to be able to detail, this is the experience I'm producing. This is what my audience looks like. This is what the numbers we're planning to generate are. And then this is how we want you to show up. We are going to have 2,000 people in person in this space. We would like 2,500 water bottles. You know, this is the demo that we're targeting, but like really, really granular. In exchange for this donation, we will feature you in 5 Instagram posts. And, you know, our Instagram numbers are X, Y, and Z. And so you'll have visibility to this type of audience, but so granular, what you're willing to give them in return for whatever it is they're giving you and exactly what it is you're looking for from those people.
And that makes a lot of sense. So all of this information, would it be best to be in some type of visual deck or a one sheet that you send to the brand?
I'm visual, right? So I typically go the deck approach. I think people are visual people. And I think if you can have it where you can have pretty imagery and just have it bulleted, okay, you know, these are our numbers, this is the demo, you can have infographics and charts. It just makes it a little bit more interesting and probably digestible. That's typically the route I would go. But.
And do you still use PowerPoint? Because I feel like society has progressed from PowerPoint and there's other ways to make decks. Where should people make decks?
Okay, see, I'm a millennial. So although I've progressed past PowerPoint, I'm still in like Google Sheets I really just aged myself because Sheets is like Excel, but I guess it's Google Slides.
Google Slides. Yeah.
So
Google
Slides. I like Slides just because it's collaborative, but you know, my friends who are designers typically might do like Keynote or InDesign or, you know, things that are just probably a lot.
And Canva too, right? I think.
But I'm like, you give me a template, you give me the colors and the fonts and I can like make that shit shake, but I'm not really, so advanced. But I like Sheets because it's collaborative, so I can be on anybody's computer and like, slides. Yes. I live in a graph for real, which is why I keep going to to Sheets. I'm more of like a grid maker. But the Google Suite in general, I just like that anyone can access it as long as they have the link.
Yeah, I like that as well. So we talked a little bit about when you're creating these decks, showing the brands your numbers and the offerings that you're willing to give them and what in exchange that they can get. What if you're new, a new company, an individual brand, and you're trying to launch? Does your deck look different?
That's a great question. And I'd imagine some of it does, right? Like you might not have some of the analytics that a more established company has. But I think, again, it goes back to having this really intimate knowledge of your audience and your market. So being able to really speak to who you anticipate being able to get this brand in front of, and just knowing your culture. At, I think Danielle Leslie has like trademarked the term, but it's really like, what is it about your experience and what you can offer that kind of enhances the overall work effort and collaboration and all of that? So knowing, okay, I know that I'm a 28-year-old woman in Brooklyn who's done X, Y, and Z, or has access to certain things, like, and I know what market and what audience I have access to. So you got to really be able to sell your story if you don't have analytics and data yet to be able to sell.
And I think that's great, selling your story. That reminds me of Daniela on our brand episode talking about being authentic. So whether you're an individual brand or a new company and trying to partnership with brands, it all comes down to authenticity. And that's what gets these brands attention and will get you the dollars.
Amen.
Yeah. I think that's how CultureCon grew so fast in the 3 years.
I mean, Desi, you were there from day one. It's funny. I saw the first CultureCon. I was like still in California, but I saw it on Instagram, like just kind of maybe as an ad, or maybe it was like Mark C that followed at the time. But I mean, I think you have a very intimate knowledge of it because you were physically on the ground for all of them.
Yeah. It was four of us. It was a four-person team. You know, we were doing our monthly events, and then we just one night said, why don't we do a conference? And so four people planned the first CultureCon. We had other people there, but the people who actually were physically there to get everything running was myself, Imani, Tequila White, and Andrea Hernandez. And we were just like the dream team, knocking it out. We were working until midnight sometimes in Imani's office when she was in New York at, you know, her building, and then just working, trying to get this conference, and obviously using our other friends and resources. Hey, do you know this person? Do you know that person? This is what we're trying to do. And we were able to make CultureCon happen. And we had 175 people the first time. For the last CultureCon, 2019, to be over 2,500, it just grew tremendously. And obviously the teams got bigger, and, you know, people were able to do, you know, now we have talent teams and then project managers and all of that. But for it to go from 175 people, that four person team, to just make its mark and cultural relevance to it being here and as big as it is now, is amazing. Is
chef's kiss. It's crazy and it's beautiful to see.
Well, you're leading that because Sunny is the product manager. So yeah, we're talking about my early days. I'm not as involved as I was before, you know, but Sunny makes sure everything happens. So let's talk a little bit more about this process with ideation to execution in this brand partnership. So we have this idea. We know that, and I don't want to focus too much on CultureCon, but we'll just make this one example and then move on. So we knew, okay, this is going to be our date for CultureCon, which we now know is June, and all of the details that go into that. And then all the decks go out to the brands. And so what's the next step?
Well, I think in any kind of event planning or like project manager, it's always working backwards, right? So you establish the date, and then you're able to determine, okay, so if we want to launch this event, you know, June 12th, when do tickets need to go on sale? When does talent need to be locked in by? When does talent need to record? Like literally every single detail you can imagine needs to be kind of thought about and a date attached to it. So that's usually how we start, is like you select the date and then every kind of thing that's required to build that, you create the work back schedule or like production schedule associated with that. You know, again, solidifying like what your offerings are, what the packages might look like. So does that include, you know, inclusion on a panel, or does that include, I don't know, your name is on the banner or your name is on the logo. Like, what is it that we're trying to offer people in exchange for coming on as a partner? And so then you can kind of start those conversations and those decks. But yeah, I think the first kind of step is really determining every single detail and like what date things need to be completed by. Then you can, you know, develop your teams. And so they know what they're supposed to be working and trying. That's kind of like, I feel like I'm a dot connector, like as a project manager. I see very high level all the things that are happening, but I'm not necessarily in each and every, like I should know everything that's going on, but I don't necessarily have to be in every conversation as long as I've empowered my team to know what dates they should be tracking to and what deliverables they should be tracking to.
And you talked about a work back schedule, and I know you had posted about this before. So Sunny's dad owns Earl's on Crenshaw. If you do not know, you better know now. Earl's on Crenshaw. Okay, let me tell y'all what my favorite things there. I go get a salmon burger with barbecue sauce and cheddar cheese and lettuce. So basic on a wheat bun. And then the Frito pie. So you know that is chili with Frito chips. But tell us about Earl's and then tell us what a work back schedule is.
So yes, Earl's on Crenshaw, 3864 Crenshaw Boulevard. We are open Monday through Saturday.
yes.
It is a restaurant.
Black owned, by the way.
It is an LA staple. My dad and my uncle went into business, geez, over 30 years ago. It started as a hot dog cart, and they've since built it into a restaurant and a catering company. And I started working at Earl's literally from the time I could see over the counter. I'm like 5'1", so I'm always been really tiny, but I was really like, not even exaggerating, I was probably like 9 or 10. And I just knew the entire menu. I knew the prices. This was before POS machines. So I literally would have to like type in the numbers on the cash register. But like my dad had me on the schedules for Saturdays. So I was there on the like on the top shift working and taking orders and catering and all of that. So, you know, I think my love for entrepreneurship and my work ethic was definitely developed and honed very early. But one of the things my dad has always emphasized is the importance of working backwards. And it used to be so annoying. Like if we were going out on a Sunday, he'd be like, well, what time does the movie start? It starts at 4. Okay, so if it starts at 4 and we want to eat first, then we probably should leave the house at this time so that we could be at this place by this time to eat. You're going to need this. Like, and I'd just be like, what? Like, who thinks like this? Like, just tell us. And now I work in events, and it's literally the first step that we have to do when we're starting to like develop a project is figure out what are the dates and how we're working backwards. I for Easter, this is like the Virgo in me, but it was my first time cooking like a holiday meal for people, and it was just like 6 of us. But I was like, oh shit, I'm cooking like multiple sides, and like they have different cook times and temperatures, and I was stressed. And so I literally created a work back plan. Like, all right, if we're gonna eat at 8 o'clock, then I need to take the chicken out the fridge at this time so that it's room temperature to go on the stove at this time. Like literally just, I was still late. We were like an hour late to eating. It was a lot less stressful than it probably would have been if I was just trying to figure out like, as I was going, what I needed to do.
Yeah. So work backwards, guys, you know, secure the date and then fill in the blanks from there. I think that's the moral of this story that we were trying to tell you, how to get these ideas from ideation to execution. And earlier you mentioned, you know, working with these different brands and sending them the decks. And now we are in a digital space. I know. Is there any concerns for cancellation of events in a digital space?
I mean, I think that might always be a risk, but I think, and you probably could really touch on this, it's setting your terms and conditions when the event or ticket sales go live, right? So really being able to manage people's expectations, really detailed FAQs, like, can I get a refund? No, but you can transfer a ticket, or, you know what I mean? Whatever the language is, to make sure you're protecting yourself. It's so interesting. I don't know what I was looking at the other day, but something about it might have been Airbnb, something about the refund policy, like, mentioned COVID, but like, I don't think COVID was enough to be able to cancel the reservation. I think we're so past that point where it's like, okay, yeah, we recognize that COVID is a risk, and you're now assuming that risk when you make this reservation. You know what I mean? It's not the early days where it's like, okay, yeah, the state's closed, I literally can't leave. It's like, well, you knew shit might be closed, you still decided to book a year later. So just really being upfront with what your terms and conditions are. And then people are opting into that once they buy the ticket, but you got to protect yourself on the front end from those cancellations or whatever the case may be. You can't do it after the fact unless you got money.
Yeah, exactly. And I think from the legal standpoint, and we again spoke about this on the last brand episode, force majeure clauses and how important those are. You know, these are very much ramped up now, COVID related. And again, force majeure is you being able to cancel something because of an act of God. But, you know, I was talking to a client this week about it. Actually, I was talking to Imani about it, and we were thinking about cancellation in the event space. So I didn't necessarily feel like a force majeure clause was completely necessary. How can you cancel a digital event? Because we're at home, people already bought the tickets. You can either attend or not. The sponsors are already locked in. Everything is done ahead of time. But then I thought, well, maybe let's put something in there going back to the old force majeure clauses of if there's a cyber attack or internet outage, power outage, and you can't actually log on. So we can't, if we guarantee a certain number of viewers or posts or something like that, maybe we can't physically do it if those type of situations. But I think the risk is pretty low for digital event cancellations, unless maybe canceled based on ticket sales. But that's something that, you know, it's not necessarily covered in a force majeure clause. But when you've mentioned COVID and force majeure clauses now, they do have COVID provisions of, you know, if there's a COVID outbreak, one, you need to make sure that all of your people are tested. And there's sometimes, like, again, like you said, with the Airbnb, you're assuming the risk by coming that you might be exposed to COVID. So neither one of us are liable if you get it. And you got to do your part to protect yourself, just like I'll do my part. So I think that's something that is really, you know, something to consider, but also changing now that we're opening up and people are getting vaccines. But we don't get into that vaccine situation.
That's a different conversation.
So let's see more about brands. So we have how you reach out to them. We have those different types of pitches, you know, what you'll give them in return. Let me dive into a little bit more. What were some of your favorite brand partnerships outside of, I know I asked you favorite brands to work for, but, you know, different gives or tasks that you had, partnerships outside of, like, maybe
Filtercom? That is a great question. I mean, so this, again, I worked for an experiential agency for 2 years. So they did all of Live Nation's business to business or B2B activations. And so, gosh, 2018 and 2019, so I was like 25 and then 26, I got to go to Cannes, and they do this really big, like, festival. Yes, girl, I was in the south of France. Layton is really big. It's called the Cannes Lion Festival of Creativity. And so it's literally like every major brand has a presence there. And it's, you're literally like overlooking the ocean. I mean, Twitter does this huge, like they call it Twitter Beach. And it's like freaking huge. Spotify, iHeart, Facebook, Instagram, like everybody kind of has a presence there. And then they just, it's literally a week long of like meetings, panels, and then also these just like epic villa parties every night. And so that was just really dope. One, it exposed me to like an international market. So things are a lot different there when you're negotiating contracts and prices. Are you doing things in euros? Are you looking at conversion rates? Are you looking at like differences in taxes? Mm-hmm. Like all of that type of stuff I thought was really interesting. And granted, I had a very like bird's eye view. We would use a production company that was based in Europe just because they had more intimate knowledge of that world. But like, that was like shit that I probably would have never thought about. Like, okay, if my rate is 100 US, yeah, how does that translate in Europe? Or if my budget is 100 US, what can I realistically and feasibly get like in this different market where what's the pound, you know, I don't know what the pound is or what the conversion rate is, but that money doesn't stretch as far, you know? So that was always yeah, really interesting. And then again, you're just in, you're in a place where it's like C-suite level and like, quote unquote, some of the most creative minds in the world are literally all kind of in this hub. So those, you know, I think yeah, in terms of like, you know, I think my career is still growing and developing, but that's definitely like a top five moment, those 2 years. And then afterwards, since I was already in Europe, I did like solo trips and would go to Paris and London and things like that afterwards, because it was a train ride away. And, you know, I was already on that side yeah, of the world. So that was always really cool. I think CultureCon has been the most fulfilling, but I think Cannes has been like the most cool and probably like eye-opening for sure.
Yeah, sounds like it. And South girl, France, so much rosé. Nothing like it. So how does working with brands differ if you're trying to get them to come on to your event and sponsor it and pay, as opposed to if they reach out to you to be a part of theirs or create mm, something for them?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, I think the things to look out for, right, if a brand is approaching you is like, what are the deliverables? So what are they asking you to give them? What are they providing you in return? I think I've seen so much of that with one of my clients in the tech space, or one of the contracts I have in the tech space, is a lot of times, you know, we will sponsor events for exposure. Mm-hmm. It's literally just because it's like an industry level. It's an advertising yeah, week, or it's an upfront or something like that, where we're going to be able to reach the marketers and the advertising agencies and stuff that we want to get our product in front of. So yeah, we're willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars to have our logo included in a website, or to have, you know, to have somebody in, on our exec team speak on a panel. And a lot of times, you know, those brands will know, or those companies will know that, okay, XYZ tech company is willing to pay this money, so let's bring them in. And then, you know, I think a lot of times in that type of space, the return for us is lead generation. Like people are paying for data. So happy to give you this money. Let me know who's like watched my segment.
And I think that's a great point. Data is what it comes down to at the end of the day. They want exposure to your audience so they can figure out how to leverage it and make more money, and the people from you and, you know, others like you. And so that's very important, I think, to ask. And so it's just reminding me of some of these influencer brand agreements that I do, and that is important, and paid media behind social posts. So that's when brands, if you're creating content for them, you know, kind of see if in the agreement they are saying they want to whitelist or put or boost the post and put paid media behind it, and make sure if you are allowing them to do that, you're getting a percentage of that profit, that because that's additional money. that they're getting. So ask for that. And I think it depends on the level of talent, but sometimes a brand might say, if we're doing this paid media whitelisting boosting, they want your social login information. So, you know, it's up to you and who you are. If you want to actually give them your login, I don't know if your DMs are risque and they go look at it, but you know, you might want to have that barrier and not give them the login and tell them you'll give them the information at a certain date. So that was one thing that I found very interesting with this whole whitelisting and paid media boost. Data drives everything.
Girl, lead generation. You gotta have a number. All, like that's what it is. Sometimes it's hard though to measure that. So we have some partnerships where it's all digital. And it's like, again, how can you guarantee that we're gonna have X amount of people tuned into this conversation? How can you guarantee that they're going to interact on social or that it'll get the numbers? Like I think that is probably the riskiest part of these digital destinations or digital experiences, is that I can't count the number of bodies in the room and be like, okay, I know that X amount of people were like physically in this space tuned in and interacting with your product and you're in this experience. People could be passively looking, people could be tuned in for part of it and then out. Like, it's hard to measure that sometimes.
And on a personal level, how do you interact with brands when they reach out to you or you want to collaborate with them? Is it different from the work that you do on the company side?
I mean, I'm definitely not like an influencer or anything of that nature, but I think I set goals and I know what feels aligned with like what'll get me to those goals. One of them for this year has been public speaking. So it's been nice to like have opportunities like this come up. And I've had a couple of other speaking and like moderating opportunities come up. So anytime it's something like that, it's like, okay, yeah, this is like checking the box. This is helping me polish my public speaking skills. Girl, clearly they ain't that polished, but
but the people are in tune and engaged.
But you know what I mean? This is all really helpful in terms of like what my long-term goals are. So that's just kind of how I measure everything. Career opportunities, projects that I take on as a freelancer, is like what long-term goals is this helping, or even short-term goals, but like what goals is this helping me meet, and like how does it feel aligned? Because if not, why are you doing it? I want to be able to really give, like, come as my authentic self. That if it's not aligned.
A lot of times I'm seeing now, particularly on social media is a curse sometimes or annoying sometimes, but you just be so addicted. You know, I love the meme that it's a girl cooking or a GIF, whatever, GIF cooking, like I can't pay my bills or eat with exposure, right? It's a conundrum. I think that obviously partner with brands that make sense for your business, because you are a business. And if you have an actual business, but sometimes brand partnerships for exposure make sense, because will you get that viewability
right
on your own? And so I did something that probably, if it was a different client, maybe I wouldn't have had my client sign the agreement if they paid me to do it for them. I would have been like, I don't know, but it ultimately is up to you. Yeah. You got to think of the pros and the cons. So yes, let's all get to the bag.
But well, that's what I was going to say, is you got to be honest with where you are on that. You know what I mean? Like, no exposure can't pay the bills, but like, do you have exposure yet? Because that will also help get you to the bag. Like, so you gotta, I think this hustle culture, and I want everybody to win, and I do want people to be paid properly. I never have a problem paying people what they deem their worth, but you gotta be honest with yourself about where you are in that journey. And like, yeah, is this a partnership that may not be paid, but it'll pay me in like in the long term? And that's another thing I've learned from my dad, is he said when he was like very early starting off, there'd be a lot of clients that he'd offer a discount, or sometimes, you know, he'd tell people like, I think you should have this product, and they wouldn't want to pay for it. You know, like, I don't want it. But he just knew like, no, they need to have this. And he would comp it and give it to them anyway. And it would always either lead to new clients, yeah, or they'd love the product that he pushed on them, that they would do it. He'd get more jobs from that particular like product. So you gotta, it's a gamble sometimes, but you gotta know sometimes if taking that short loss will really like set you up for more success.
Yeah. You got to think long term and not short term. And so, I mean, that goes into something that we're talking about social media and this exposure and stuff, what has been bothering me lately. This is a mini rant, but you know, people, again, think long term. People are mad, in particular people that work behind the scenes and are creative, sometimes them not getting credit for their work. So like a hairstylist or makeup artist. But do I have to credit you for a service that I'm paying you for? Like, I don't. I don't have a legal contractual obligation. I don't have an ethical obligation. Like, if I decide to tag you because you did my makeup, and this is not a personal story, I'm just saying like a lot of talent getting attacked online, and it really bothers me for not crediting a makeup artist. They don't have to credit you for doing their makeup. They paid you to do their makeup, so they don't have to credit you, because ultimately what you're trying to get is that exposure from them based on their followers and people who follow them. So if people like their makeup, they'll book you. Now, should you be paying them for that exposure?
Or would your recommendation be to be like, hey, such and such, can I do your makeup complimentary in exchange for a post or a tag or a shout out if you like it?
Yes, that's the exchange. But if I'm hiring you to do my makeup, then I don't have to tag you. But if I want to do your makeup, or you hit me up to do your makeup, and I'll be like, hey, I'ma just do it, girl. Please tag me on Instagram to take advantage of these 20,000 followers I have. That will lead to more clients. So you want that exposure. But now you're trying to get a double bite at the apple. You want them to pay you for the service and the exposure. For me, crediting only is required if it's like an editorial or film or whatever, and the actual brand, company, publication, if you negotiate it right, has to credit you. And that'll be in the publication, magazine. And they don't necessarily have to do it on social if you didn't agree to that and that wasn't a part of it. Typically, the agreement will say, we'll credit you in a publication if I'm hiring you to do makeup for a talent in a magazine. So when there's rants from these people or people around them, I'm just like, y'all do not know anything. Shut up. But then that also makes you unhireable, because it was you got to think long term, right? Like, if I see a person, a makeup artist, and I'm not attacking makeup artists, but this is the first thing on my mind. If I see a makeup artist or someone who's connected to them go on a rant about that person not getting credited, I will never hire them.
I mean, in general, I just don't believe in acting a fool, particularly publicly, because for that very reason. But, you know, you hear of like the myths of people being blackballed, but I didn't realize it's like a thing.
Well, even internally, you know, like you wouldn't work with those people. So I know that I wouldn't hire somebody personally that I saw going on a rant on social media. Because if I make you mad or you feel like you owe something and you actually are not.
I mean, honestly, the term? It's like, I'd rather be respected than well-liked. Like, I don't abide by that. I want to be an ethical person always. I want to be well-liked. That doesn't mean I'm a pushover, but like, I think people respect you when they like you and when they, you know what I mean? And that will then inspire me to post you or to work with you again or whatever the case may be. But yeah, some of that entitlement has to go. I think that's a really fair point. Like, you are paying for a service, so it's not obligatory that they shout you out as well.
All that to say is you are a brand. Everybody is a brand if you are providing a service, and so you should carry yourself as such. Have your agreements, have your work back list, have your decks, have your portfolios, so you can secure long-term bags and not short-term bags, right? So yeah, I mean, I think this was a really great discussion and expansion on the business side of things of brand partnerships and events, particularly because we're opening back up. And, you know, there are a lot of people who want to get into the event space, who want to curate their own events and just figure out more so how to do it. And I think you gave them really good insight. So if there's three things that you want people who work in the event space and who are trying to work in an event space or are trying to secure brand partnerships, what are three steps or things that you want to leave them with?
That's a really great question.
To make that happen.
I think the first is just having, and I know I keep using this word, but like a really intimate knowledge of your audience and whoever it is you're marketing something for or building an experience for. What is it they want and how can you best provide that for them? I think two, how can you create something both digitally and or in person that kind of touches on all the senses? Like, so you want it to be immersive and you want it to be a sensory experience. So whether that's thinking about food and beverage integration or sonically what it sounds like, what the space smells like. I mean, I get that granular sometimes. I think that's really important. And three, I think, again, finding things. So whether that's a brand, an activity, a look and feel, a story, narrative, or whatever, like it needs to feel really authentic to whatever it is you're trying to build and who it is you're trying to market it to. So the intimate knowledge of the space or of the people, creating something that feels like really stimulating to all the senses, and then, yeah, really coming as your authentic self and finding partnerships and alignment with who you are and what it is you're trying to build.
I love that. And that authenticity, you know, narrative has continued on. And so just be you, do you, and the money will come, right? So Sunny, where can people find you if they just want to connect on a personal level, if they want to hire you as their project manager, event producer, because you are a freelancer. So let's
Hello. I'm on Instagram at underscore Sunny Day, and it's DAE. And then I have a website where you can also reach out to me. My email and everything is listed. It's sunnyday.co. So that's SUNNYDAE.co.
Thank you so much, Sunny, for joining us. It was great to have you. Pop Law Podcast listeners, I'm so happy to bring you a different experience on this interview series. We'll be mixing it up a little bit, you know, legal, non-legal, but definitely expanding on topics that are important to our audience. If you have any questions and want to reach out to us, want us to talk about topics that haven't been covered or any ideas, please visit www.poplawpodcast.com. You can also visit us at Pop Law Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and the show can be heard on all platforms.
Yes.
We global out here. I'm Desiree. This is Pop Law Podcast. And please remember, I am still not your attorney.
Everybody loves McDonald's fries. So yes, you accused your mom of stealing some of your fries on the way home. But the bag did feel a little light. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.